On November 6th, 7th, and 8th, Ohio and Indiana held a joint ACB convention in Cincinnati, Ohio, and our banquet speaker was Kathy Nimmer, Indiana's Teacher of the Year, and it's a speech well worth listening to. So here it comes. The introduction did not get recorded, but at the beginning of her speech, Kathy talks about her book 2+4=1, celebrating the partnership of people with disabilities and their assistance dogs. It's DB74137. Here's Kathy Nimmer.
So good to be here in a room with such energy and positivity and good food. So thank you. And for all of those who are sitting there analyzing the title of my book and thinking, yep, 2+4=1, she definitely teaches English and not math. Let me just give the subtitle or the explanation of that. That is about two eyes, ears, hands, feet, plus four paws equals one magical union. And the wonderful experiences that I've had with my guide dogs and also lots of people from around the world with all kinds of disabilities and their assistance dogs. So anyway, I'm really, really glad to be here. I want to add to what I have heard has been a magnificent weekend, and let's hear it for all of the organizers who've made this so successful. I have been privileged to be on a wild journey, especially this last year, but I want to start my time talking with you this evening in 2011. At that time, I had been a member at a local gym for a long time and decided to revisit swimming, which I had liked recreationally when I was younger and I hadn't done for a long, long time. And so I began a swimming regimen that really I enjoyed a lot. And in hindsight, looking back over those months of swimming, I probably could have put some pieces together that something was going wrong, but I didn't put them together. Once in a while, I would have seriously burning skin or eyes afterward, but I just put that off to, you know, the newness of the chemicals. Once in a while, at night after a hard swim, I would feel like a furnace-like sensation in the trunk of my body, and I thought that was really strange. I wasn't sweating or anything. It was just strange, and I thought, oh, that's just like metabolism. I had an excuse for every odd symptom that was occurring during my months of training in the pool until the night of May 12th, 2011, when I went into the gym, dropped off by my sighted ride, and the pool was empty, and it was a gym where there was no lifeguard, but I was a very competent swimmer, so there was no worry. In fact, I liked the empty pool. It was adding to my solitude and my peace, and so I got in with no suspicion that my life was about to change. I swam. I'm a backstroker, so my ears were in the water, and I'm swimming. And about halfway down the lane, it happened. And what it was, I couldn't put words to at the time. But my lungs suddenly filled up with fluid that started shooting out of my mouth and nose like a fountain. And my lungs were crackling. I could hear it under the water with, you know, my ears that were in the water. And I grabbed the side of the pool and thought, what in the world is going on? And in every breath, this fluid was just gushing out of me. And I rested for a while. And, you know, I'm fairly smart and seasoned, but I'd never heard of anything like this. And, of course, I was completely alone. So I just rested. I thought, oh, this will pass, whatever's going on. And so it eased down, and I started to try to swim again, and it came right back with a vengeance. By the time I figured out whatever was happening was serious and I needed to get help, I was at the far end of the lane, and I knew I couldn't get back to where my stuff was by swimming. So inch by inch, praying for that gym door to open and admit another swimmer, I made my way back toward the end of the pool where I had started, holding onto the wall. And it was agonizing because I could not get a deep breath. I was so dizzy and so just completely terrified and unsure of what was happening. Finally, I got back to the ladder that was near the end, and I tried to pull myself up, but I was too weak. I could not get out. And no one came in. Of course, they didn't at that time. Finally, I was able to pull myself kind of like belly flop onto the side of the pool, and I crawled over to where I had left my stuff, and I realized that for the first time, I had forgotten to bring my cell phone. So I sat in that chair, leaning against the wall, gasping and waiting, and no one came. Then it got a little better, and I thought, you know, I probably have 15 minutes or so until my ride was going to come back and pick me up, so I could make my way over to the whirlpool, which was maybe 10 feet from there, and surely that would help, because frankly, whirlpools pretty much help everything, you know? And I thought, hot tub cure, I'm going to do this. And so I used my cane to get over there. I never took my dog to the pool, and I got in down into that water, and I almost lost consciousness because the fumes from that whirlpool about knocked me out, and that fluid was gushing out of me again. I got out, got back to that chair, and right around that time, my dad, who'd been my ride for that day, came. And holding tightly to his arm, I did get out of that gym and right to the emergency room, where I was diagnosed with acute chemical pneumonitis. What had been happening is that my body had decided that chlorine and bromine were poison to me. For whatever reason, my body was building up an intolerance. Think of it as, you know, a cup of fluid filling up and it would get that brimming over, would get really close, and then I'd leave the pool area and it would go back down. But every time I swam, that level would get higher and higher, and going into a newly treated pool with no one else to break up the chemicals, that pushed me over the edge and my lungs shut down. And I had severe and moderate damage respectively in my two lungs. I lost the entire end of the school year of teaching. I was in the hospital for days. I was on high steroids for months, and I sustained permanent lung damage. But during those months immediately following this crazy incident that I had never heard of happening to anyone, I had a lot of time to think. Because for the first time in my life, I couldn't do anything. I was in bed, and getting up to go across the room to the bathroom was a feat. And as a doer, I imagine there are some real doer personalities in this room, I felt completely worthless. Like, I think I had always defined my value as a human being by what I could accomplish. And all of a sudden, I couldn't accomplish anything. And in those months, I had a lot of time to evaluate what was important in my life. A lot of time to try to figure out what really mattered. And in that framework, I want to share with you tonight a few of the lessons that I came upon, that I learned about myself during those months when I could do nothing more than lie there and think. Those come in five L's: the importance of learning, laughing, loving, losing, and living. As I lay in that bed in 2011, I thought really hard about the things that I had learned and about the people who had helped me learn. It's not that I hadn't considered my teachers before, because I myself was a teacher, so of course I thought of them. But I thought really hard during that time about all that they gave me. From that third grade teacher who was there when I was first diagnosed with a degenerative retinal disease, and she didn't coddle me, she didn't excuse the assignments that I had missed when being diagnosed and all that. She pulled me aside and she caught me up, and she showed me that learning, no matter what my vision would end up being, that learning would always be this stepping stone and this foundation, and that I could lean upon that. And then in fifth grade, my last year in public school, that teacher, she knew that I needed a very strong positive memory for my last few days in public school because everything would be changing after that. I'd be leaving home for the Indiana School for the Blind 3 hours from my house. And so I had always been the super fast runner, really a great sprinter, and I'd always been the anchor on our relay team for field day, which was always the last day of school. I figured she'd pull me from that because while I could still see to run between the lines, I certainly couldn't see the second fastest runner running toward me with the baton. But no, what she did instead, she pulled that girl over and she said, "Girl," I don't remember what her name was, she said, "Girl, you shout, Kathy, Kathy, Kathy," as you're running toward her so she knows you're coming. I think that girl's probably still in therapy, but not my problem, right? So I started jogging when I heard my name, and she slapped that baton in my hand, and I stayed between those lines, and I won. And that teacher, I won it for the team, and that teacher, again, she gave me that courage to think outside the box, to think, you know, there is a way around just about everything. And when I left public school and went to the School for the Blind in Indianapolis, I learned a lot from those teachers, too. And especially in that building, I consider the teachers not just the people who stood behind those desks and who administered the academic content to us. I consider all of the students who were there at that same time my teachers too, because suddenly it wasn't me, the blind kid, the only blind kid in the school. Suddenly everyone had something with their eyes. And from the highest partials down to the totally blind, we shared that commonality, and it was the first time in my life. Do you remember that first time in your life when you're in a room with people with vision issues, and it's like no longer a thing? Like, it's normal for people to, you know, trail along a wall sometimes, or to bump into you, or to just like, hey, wonder what color this is. It's normal, you know, for the clatter of a Perkins Braille writer, or you'll know how old I am now, the slate and stylus. I don't even know if the kids still do that. I don't know. You know, it's normal. It's normal for food to be described on a plate as if on a clock. It's normal nowadays to have the talking devices. They were just really coming into play when I was getting older at that school. And so it was okay. And I learned that it didn't have to be this looming monster, this loss of vision. And even in ninth grade when I had to learn Braille, I fought it. I just had this sense, it was a line I didn't want to cross. But I learned it because the students around me helped me know that if I didn't learn it, I'd be illiterate. And I still am a firm, firm believer in the importance of Braille, and hope that all the kids hope that all the kids walking through vision loss now learn to appreciate what that's all about. And of course, the teachers gave me a lot too. From the piano teacher who helped me discover a gift for playing that I did not even know I had, to the biology teacher who put a scalpel in our hands and helped us dissect frogs. You know, I still can't get over that. 12 blind people with scalpels. I am not that brave as a teacher. To the independent living skills that I gained there, the cane travel, the knowledge of how to cook, the confidence that I could be what ultimately turned out to be nearly totally blind, and I could still succeed, and I could still be happy. And while I lay in that bed in 2011 and contemplated what I had learned, I became grateful and more resigned and committed to the fact that while learning does not always occur when we want it or how we want it, it is constant and perpetual, and we must recognize and acknowledge it and appreciate it. So after learning, I also learned, as I lay in that bed, that laughter had been such an important part of my development as a human being, and how much I appreciated it now, especially when so easily I could have lost my life in that pool. And so I just thought I'd take a few minutes and share some of the funny moments that popped into my head as I did that kind of life in review thing in 2011. Because let's just admit it, being blind is absolutely hysterical sometimes, right? Yeah, it's nuts. You know, you've been here on these things, I'm sure. Like when you thrust your hand out to shake someone's hand, and it's not the hand that you hit. Instead, it's usually something really gushy and soft. And depending on the height of the person, that gushiness could have various sources. Yeah, you know that. And how many times do we talk to somebody who is no longer there, right? And do tell me this, how many times have you talked about somebody who is standing right there? Right? I was really involved in cheerleading at the blind school, and when I tell audiences about this, they're like, there is no way that a team of 7 blind girls could do cheerleading. And I'm like, yes, we could. And I remember the one year when there was only one of us who was really like a partial sighted, and the other 6 were pretty much totals. So when we'd run out onto that mat, you know, the partial would be in the middle and the other 3 on one side, 3 on it. It was like a flock of geese migrating south. Yeah. And you line up for the cheer, and that poor partial's like, oh, shoot, got to go move this one so she's not got her back to the audience, you know, and all that stuff. And then ready, go, and you do this cheer, and then you move in for the mount, you know, where you climb on each other. And if you're a bass, you hope and pray that the right girl is climbing on you. And if you're one of the ones who goes up, you hope and pray really hard. You're fine going up. It's the going down that's tricky, because if you're about to jump down from standing on someone's shoulders, you just hope you're not going to land on somebody, right? Yeah, we did that. I always tell the teenagers in the audiences I speak to, I always tell them, you know, at the blind school, we didn't do basket tosses. I don't know if you guys know what basket tosses are, but in cheerleading, you know, 2 girls will hold each other's forearms and just make this really strong base, and the little girl will kind of lay across those forearms on her belly, and the 2 holding the base will go 1, 2, 3 and fling their arms up, and the little one goes flying. Yeah, blind people don't do basket tosses. Can you just imagine? 1, 2, 3, up! Where'd she go? Has she come down yet? I don't think. Oh, well. She'll come down eventually. Yeah, we didn't do that. But I did gymnastics in high school. USABA. Any USABA people? Yeah? I loved gymnastics as a little girl before I started losing vision and got back involved, and I loved all 4 events. But one of the funniest stories in my entire life happened in training one day, because remember, I was a very good runner, and so I was particularly good at the vault. And if you've never seen a blind person vault, pretty much the coach stood at the far end of the landing mat, and she clapped, and we had counted out my steps ahead of time, and so I stood and, you know, ran toward her clap and jumped on that springboard and went over, and I was quite good. And so my coach, who was a female coach from Butler at that time, Butler University, she brought in her friend one day to watch me vault. And ladies, he had the James Earl Jones voice. You know what I mean? That deep, dark, sexy. Oh, man. And I was 14, and he walked up to me, and he said, "Hi, Kathy." And oh, and he said, "I've come to see you vault." And I'm like, gosh. Ah. I have since nicknamed him Mr. Dark Chocolate, by the way. I'm like, okay, I'm going to show you how I vault. So So I lined up, and my coach was at the far end of the landing mat, and she clapped, and, you know, oh, I smoothed out my rippling muscles, and I touched up my fluffy ponytail, and I started running, and it was poetry in motion. I'm telling you, it was grace and elegance, and as I passed Mr. Dark Chocolate, I gave him a look. Well, I would have if I'd known where he was, but... That blind thing is sometimes inconvenient, but I punched that springboard so hard, and oh man, it was harder than I had ever punched it before, and I reached out kind of in like a push-up position, toes pointed, back arched, head just poised just so, and I was like, yeah, this is the best vault ever, and I kept reaching for the vault. And reaching for the vault. And then it dawned on me, I should have touched the vault by now. Something is wrong. Perhaps, Kathy, you have jumped a little too hard. Perhaps you shouldn't have let the adrenaline and all those other hormones affect your particular punch off that springboard. Ladies and gentlemen, I not only never touched that vault with my hands, but I never touched it with my chest, my ribs, my waist, my thighs, my knees, my shins, or my toes. I jumped over that blasted thing completely. I didn't even nick it with my toes. But I will say I kept perfect form the whole time. Them toes were pointed. And I did not take any steps on the landing because, frankly, you can't take steps when you land on your belly. And after my coach stopped laughing, she said, Kathy, are you okay? And I'm like, yes. And then I did what any respectable 14-year-old girl does. I ran in the bathroom and I cried. And here's the scoop, like the sequel of that. I am still positive that that was my chosen mate by God, Mr. Dark Chocolate, because I'm 46 and I'm still single. And had I kept better control that day, like I'd have been married to Mr. Dark Chocolate one day. Oh, well. It wasn't funny then, but it is darn funny now. It's funny now. You know what? And it's also funny about them, their dogs. Clap if you're a guide dog user, if you've ever been. Yeah. Love them, love them, love them. I'm on my fourth. Nacho is his name from Guiding Eyes. He did not come with me today. I strained something in my back, and working him hurts a little bit right now, so he got the weekend off. But love those dogs. They're wonderful, and they are absolutely so incredibly imperfect. Are they not? Yeah, you know. And I have to say, when they mess up, it's not usually funny at the time, but it's really funny later if you let it be. Like my first dog, Raffles, a golden retriever, we were heading toward a staff meeting, or actually I think it was a parent meeting, and it was really serious. I ran him outside before I went, and on the way up the stairs, I felt him pause, but I thought nothing of it. So he's a golden, you know, very noble, very wonderful. Walk down the hall all the way across the school. Get to the conference room where everything goes dead silent. And then people start to laugh. And I'm like, oh, no. And I reach down to Raffles, my noble golden. And I find that my boy was helping clean up the environment because he picked up a discarded jelly donut from those stairs. And carried it all the way across the building. Now, give him this. He did not eat it. He just carried it. But do you recall what's on a golden's chest? A whole bunch of fur that now was coated with a whole bunch of jelly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then my third one, who just retired, Elias, who just retired this year, he had, like, his thing was sniffing, you know, not out of control, but it was something I never totally erased. He would, like, we'd walk through the mall in the summertime, and all of a sudden I'd hear this, woo! And I thought, yep, He just smelled a teenage girl's butt. But you know what I mean? You can't correct it if it's already done, you know? I called those drive-by sniffings, and it was just part of the story, you know? And then has your dog ever farted? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Or belched, or barfed, or whatever. Yeah. Or decided that sniffing thing was just as appropriate. You know, when they meet each other, you know, they sniff their private parts, and occasionally they'll decide that that must transfer to humans as well, right? So they're wonderful, and you've got to laugh, right? You just got to laugh. And they add so much joy, and there is so much joy. And as I lay in that bed in 2011, I made a commitment to not just keep laughing, but to appreciate that laughter. Because again, it could have been no more for me then. And I decided that laughter was so much a part of my journey that I was going to cherish. Love comes after that. So learning, laughing, loving. And for me, it was the love of teaching. I wanted to be a teacher. I had such fantastic teachers, and I wanted to be a teacher. And I knew I could teach at a school for the blind, and I knew those kids needed a great model. But my heart was for a public school, and so I prepared. And I will confess, I had no idea how I was going to do it. I was smart, I was creative, and I was driven. But I still, when I started at Harrison High School in 1992, I was clueless. I wanted to teach. I knew the material, and I had no idea how to be a good teacher, let alone a good blind teacher. And the first years were hard. They were horrible. My kids from that era don't remember it as badly as I do, but I remember it, and a lot of it had to do with my blindness. It's the elephant in the living room. It's true. It's part of my story. I own it. There were kids tiptoeing out of my room. There were kids switching seats. There were kids cheating. You know, it was not good. And the climax came one day when there was so much horseplay in my room, because I did not have good classroom management, that a kid threw a book bag, and he wanted to throw it toward someone, but it missed, and it shattered my classroom window. It broke. And other teachers came running, and I stood there. And I broke. I broke. I broke inside, because what I knew was it wasn't that book bag that was the issue, that was a symptom of the lack of control that I had. And I had no idea how to change it. And that was the day before spring break. And I went home and I cried and I prayed the entire spring break. And I'll tell you what I prayed. I said, I prayed for plan B. What do I want to do instead of this? Because I'm obviously not doing this well. And I didn't get an answer. And it's like, I wanted to teach. I still wanted to teach. And there was still a little ounce of me beneath all that pain and discouragement and embarrassment. I was humiliated that I was failing so badly. There was still part of me that believed I could still do well. And so I brainstormed a list of good teaching techniques, not good blind teaching techniques, but good teaching techniques. I'd been, for instance, afraid to move around the room because I didn't want the embarrassment of bumping into a desk or tripping on a kid's foot or getting disoriented. So I'd stayed mostly behind my desk or at a podium, and I vowed, nope, I'm going to move. I'm going to move around. I wanted to not be all me yik-yakking, but I wanted to interact more with them. But I'd been afraid that I would mistake one of their voices, you know, because you have to learn names by voices. And I didn't want to make a mistake. So I thought, nope, no more fear of that. I had such passion and creativity, but I'd been afraid of looking embarrassed, you know, looking too overanimated and all. I'm like, nope, no more fear of that. And so I came back with this little list of new strategies, and I used them in April and May on these kids who'd been hardened to me and not behaved well all year. And I saw some little signs of possible hope. And I decided, okay, I'm coming back one more year, and I'm going to start fresh with these new approaches. And if it works, I'm staying with teaching. And if it doesn't, I am leaving, even if I don't have a plan B. Well, it worked. It worked. Suddenly my classroom was no longer this place that I dreaded because I was afraid of making a mistake. I owned my mistakes. And suddenly I was not any longer this blind person who felt really burdened by that, like that was the biggest thing in my classroom. I used it. I used it for fun. I used it to be interactive. I couldn't know what the kids were doing if I didn't talk a lot with them. So I talked a lot with them. And suddenly they were more involved and less inclined to misbehave. I wanted them to learn vocabulary. I wanted to do it differently. So I invented Blind Pictionary, where I grabbed a marker and went up to the whiteboard and I drew pictures for them. And here's the secret. You know this if you saw when you were younger. You know all that stuff. You can probably still draw fairly well, but that wasn't going to be any fun. So I drew way worse than I had the ability to do. So they would laugh. And so like I'd hear them like, is that an alligator or an ice cream cone? You know, they're talking with each other. And then one kid would say, wait, the word frigid is on the vocab list. That means cold. Maybe it's an ice cream cone. And daggone it, they learned and they laughed and they had fun. And they also became desensitized to feeling weird about my disability. And then as the year went on, that generalized that I hope when they left my room and when they still leave my room, they're no longer going out with this fear of how to interact with people with disabilities. They go out with an ease. And I wanted to have fun. Like if they gave a great answer, I'm like, that is worth a blind high five. And then I would seek them out, you know, and I squat down in front of the desk and all the kids would be laughing. And I'm like, now blind high five is all about counting, okay? I'm going to hold my hand up here. I can't see your hand, but we're going to count to three, and I want you to move your hand forward. Smack me right there. Let's do it. And I go, one, two, three, and it never failed. It was like a wet fish approach, like they're afraid, you know? I'm like, and then I'd say, that stunk. We need to do that again, you know? And I'd say, be confident. Be bold. One, two, three, smack, and everybody roared. And then as I backed up to my desk, yes, I often go backward, and I wave my hands behind me, and I go, beep, 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 line shot coming through, you know. As I go up, I say, you should see two blind people try to high five. That's where you can really laugh, right? And so my room is alive and it is interactive. And that's what saved me because I loved teaching and I loved kids. And I didn't know how to love my disability into a place where it was central in my classroom, but just like going to the blind school and meeting all those blind kids for the first time, it no longer was an issue. It was just part of me. I'm tall, I have curly hair, I'm blind, I'm crazy, I'm fun, I'm creative, and kids, I love you, and I'm going to help you learn. And that's where I found my roots. And in 2011, contemplating that I almost lost all of that, I decided I was going to use every ounce of the rest of my career to never forget the love. You know, when we fall in love with a task, whatever that is, whether it is a paid job or a volunteer opportunity or a family, when we fall in love and we dig into that love and we absorb it and we give it out, then everything becomes doable. It all becomes possible. So learning, laughing, loving, and I say that part of my journey is also about loss, losing. First, of course, the losing of the vision. I'll tell you, I suffered emotionally when it went down each time. I don't know about you, but I did, and it was an adjustment emotionally. But I got through it, and I got stronger. And again, it became less of a factor as I realized that I wasn't my blindness. It was part of me, but not who I am. But then being in an active, vital school with all of these teenagers for 23 plus years, I've experienced loss in some crazy intense ways. My second year of teaching, there were four boys in a car that was hit by a semi. Three were killed. One survived. I had two who were killed and the survivor as my students. What do you say? What do you do? And then over the years, you know, other students have come and gone with their losses. One of my dearest girls lost her mom to breast cancer. You know, there were students who died of various diseases. This year, I'm off traveling around as Indiana Teacher of the Year, but on the very first day of what would have been my 24th year of teaching, I was getting ready in the morning for a speech to encourage teachers on the new day, you know, first day back. And I got a text from a friend, and she said, Rhett died, and Rhett committed suicide. Rhett was one of my students. He graduated in June. He had A's and B's the whole time I had him. He had nothing telling me anything was wrong. I didn't see any of it. No one else did either. He was a star baseball player. He had a full ride scholarship. And he died by his own hand. And I was alone because I wasn't at my school with my colleagues who were together. And I had to go give a speech. I had to go give a speech telling these teachers that teaching is worth it, that you can do this. And inside I was dying. So I went and I did the speech. And then I decided, you know what? If I don't tell them about Rhett, then I am doing what Rhett did in keeping it inside. He never told any of us how he was feeling. We didn't know. If we'd known, we would have helped. And so I stopped my speech and I said, you know what? You guys, this was a different school corporation. They didn't know about Rhett. I said, you know what? I am not okay right now. And I want to tell you why. And I told them about Rhett. And you know what? They joined me in tears. And afterward, several of them surrounded me in prayer. And it was a loss that we all, you know, loss. You may not have lost a student, but you know loss. And loss is agonizing. A few years ago, I had Casey, a girl in my creative writing class, not the best writer, not the worst writer, very quiet. Highs and lows were kind of her thing, but she was very quiet. And one night, I dreamed what she looked like. Any of you do that? You know, you dream sighted? Some of you still, yeah? And you dream sometimes of things that you know you never saw? Yeah. Say yes if you've done that? Yeah? Yeah. So I dreamed, I knew it was Casey, and of course I never saw her. So I had a decision to make that next day in class, tell her about it in front of everybody, tell her about it privately, or just don't tell her. And I decided to tell her about it in front of everyone. And she was suddenly, for the first time in her life, the center of attention, because every detail was perfectly exact. And there were so many kids saying, Casey, that's your hair. Oh my gosh. Casey, she just described your eyes exactly. She was the princess of that moment. And I was glad. I lost track of Casey through the rest of her high school, and I didn't hear about her again until I read her obituary. She died at the age of 23 from a tragic accident. And I went on her online condolence book, and I shared that memory of describing her. I shared that with her family. Months later, my principal came to me. Casey's dad had come in to talk to him. You see, Casey's favorite class her entire educational career was creative writing. And the moment she talked about more than any other was that moment when I described her. Casey's dad took all the money gathered at her visitation and donated it to my creative writing class to do something to reach other Casey's. And so last year, when everyone would have assumed that the highlight of my year was winning Indiana Teacher of the Year, was being the first Indiana national finalist since 1996, was shaking President Obama's hands, all of that would have been on their highlight reel. Here's my highlight. Last year, my creative writers joined with the sculpture students at Harrison and made a 4-foot by 6-foot tactile mosaic with all of these inspiring sayings on it, beautiful images, bright colors, and I can feel it all, and it hangs in the front hall of our school permanently, and it's called Casey's Mosaic. So through her loss, there is life and there is hope. And we all learn, we all laugh, we all love, and we all lose. And I'm determined to honor all parts of that process in the culminating one, which is live. You know what? Life is too short to be weighed down by any one thing, because we are all given a path to walk, whether that is one of wild adventure, immense travel, titles, honors, lots of money, popularity, fame, or whether that is a quiet walk where we simply live well and make the real difference in this world. We need to live aware. We need to live, pardon the pun, eyes wide open. We do, because we need to appreciate the gifts that we are given. Last year, when I won Indiana and I was up for national, I had to put together a national portfolio, and I had room in it for one letter from a student, only one. There were lots of other components, but only one from a student. And I had this stack. I had asked several students to write for me. And I had these beautiful, creative, artistic letters from all these creative writers. But I chose one from Tony. Tony was a 10th grader I had who was really struggling. He had C's, D's, and F's a lot of times, and he was very unhappy. And one day I pulled him up to the desk, and I said, Tony, what's going on? What's happening? And he started to cry. And I don't know about you, but I'm a sucker for a guy who cries, okay? That and a guy who accepts a purse to give to a friend. That's where it's at, gentlemen. That's where it's at. Anyway, so I started to cry too. And Tony told me that for years he'd felt inferior to his classmates. He just squeaked by, and now in high school it was catching up with him, and he was panicking and didn't know what to do. And so we talked, and I talked to his parents, and we talked to some others, and we made some adjustments and strategies, and he started doing better. And I knew I was instrumental in that turnaround as he went through junior year, senior year, graduated, got a 4-year degree at Indiana State in Terre Haute, and went on to the Army. He's a second lieutenant. He just finished, yeah. He just finished Ranger school after the first time trying it. And his letter is not elegant. It's short sentences, it's simple words, but this is what he wrote in his last paragraph. He said, "Miss Nimmer really turned my life around. I'm in the Army, and if anything ever happens to me in combat, I want to donate my eyes to Miss Nimmer, because she's the first person who saw me for who I was." Here's the truth, and you know it well. That kind of donation isn't even possible. But that kind of donation is what living well is all about. Because he took that kind of expression, that kind of courage to write that on the page, I already won. And I knew when I sat there as a national finalist for the interview, I knew that I was there because of Tony. And I know now, in 2011, as I look back at that turning point in my life, that I am still here because of the Tonys in this world and the Rhetts in this world and the Casey's in this world. We are all given a mission. I firmly believe that each of us has something that no one else has. Everyone has something to give that no one else has. And if we live faced internally, we look inside instead of outward, and we don't look at what each other needs, if we live for ourselves, we are going to miss that chance to give what we alone have. And that's not living. Since 2011, my world has changed. This journey of Indiana Teacher of the Year, this chance to exercise my passion for public speaking in this year when I'm waived from the classroom to be an ambassador, to serve. I look back at 2011, and I think of that pool, and I'm grateful. I did not come out of that incident unscathed. Nothing has been normal since then. But happily, nothing has been normal since then. Because in that time where I could do nothing, I realized the importance of learning, of laughing, of loving, of losing, and of living. And I realized that my value does not come in what I do. It's in what I learn, what I laugh about, what I love, what I lose, and how I live. And that's what we all have the opportunity to do. Thank you.
Standing ovation, folks, for a magnificent banquet speech. Yeah. This audience is on its feet.
I'll hold it. Okay. Wow. We have an award for Kathy. And after listening to that speech, I'm just simply going to read what is on the award because she just gave us all the reason why she deserves it. And it is the American Council of the Blind of Indiana presents the Patricia L. Price Award to Kathy Nimmer for her efforts and enthusiasm and in a persistent endeavor to enhance the quality of life of the blind and visually impaired, November 7th, 2015. It's Kathy, we present this award to you. She definitely proved several times over that she deserves an award like that.